John Cooley has reported from the Middle East for more than 40 years for the Christian Science Monitor and ABC News, and has written 6 books on the subject, including Payback, America's Long War in the Middle East, Unholy Wars, and most recently, An Alliance Against Babylon, the U.S., Israel, and Iraq, published by the Pluto Press in the United Kingdom and distributed in the U.S. by the University of Michigan Press. While there have been many books written about the U.S. and Iraq, John Cooley's is the first to examine what others have ignored, the role played by Israel and its connections not only at the present time, but going back decades, indeed to the Jews' Babylonian captivity in ancient times, and how historical Mesopotamia morphed into today's Iraq. Welcome, John Cooley.
Thank you very much.
I'm glad to have you on the phone. You have been visiting, studying, and writing about Iraq for many years. On the 3rd anniversary of U.S. invasion, has the current situation there left you more optimistic or pessimistic about the country's future?
I'm afraid it's left me about the same, with the same degree of pessimism and warning, if you like, that I had when the invasion started. Unfortunately, the predictions made by myself and many more people more eminent than I am were not heard, and the errors that were made in the occupation have put the United States and its British ally particularly in a very bad state of affairs.
Now, George Bush in recent statements says that it will not be under his presidency that American troops will be withdrawn. Is there any chance for any improvement from the Iraqi situation, at least, and the world situation, if American troops remain there for such a long time?
I don't think that President Bush's statement was helpful at all, because it convinces the people on our side in Iraq, the security forces we're training, the government of national unity, which we're still hoping for. It discourages them because they know that the popular feeling in Iraq is that the American and British and other troops should leave as soon as possible, even if that's an irrational wish, and even if they realize perhaps that they may have full civil war and chaos after they leave. You simply do not, there's no such thing in history that I know of as a benign occupation that was accepted by the population, whether it was the Americans in the Philippines in 1900, whether it was Germany and France and Poland and elsewhere during the Nazi period. Whether it was in the American South during the Civil War, especially that period, there is just no such thing as popular support for a military occupation by a foreign power, even if the ideology or the principles being imposed, in the case of Civil War, was end of slavery, even if they are recognized as benign. People just don't want to see foreign troops in foreign uniforms among them, no matter how well or ill-behaved they are.
Now, one of the things the U.S. has been trying to pressure the Shia into giving up the Secretary of the Interior post and also changing the prime ministership, and it would seem, at the reading your book even substantiates that the Shia, by and large, saw the U.S. invasion as their vehicle to get power, which had been denied them, and they're not about to give up that power to have some form of, like, consensual government. Is that how you see it?
Yes, I believe you're absolutely correct. They're all grades of Shia feeling from the, from Muqtada al-Sadr's Mahdi army, or even probably a Shiite elements in the Al-Qaeda terrorist networks, all the way up to Ayatollah Sistani, who has kept above the fray so far and has tried to soothe as much as he can the insurgency with support from Iran, which may be otherwise contradictorily aggravating the insurgency. I think you hit it right on the head with the statement about the reluctance of any Shia faction to give up the power that was so long denied them as a majority under Saddam Hussein and even earlier under the British occupation.
You know, one of the players that is the most, unfamiliar to the United, to American audience are the Kurds. And in your book, which is an extraordinary book, it's a small book, but has more background information on the history of this struggle than I found anywhere else. In your book, you have a chapter called Menaj a Quatre. It's the relationship between the U.S., Israel, Iran, and the Kurds. And for most Americans, even those who follow the world politics, they said the Kurds are a mystery. For the U.S. government, there are good Kurds. For the U.S. government, there are bad Kurds. Those who have allied themselves with the U.S. and Israel and with the Shah in Iran in the past were the good Kurds, and the bad Kurds are the ones who the Turks oppress, and we don't hear very much about them. Maybe you could give some background to the listeners about the Kurdish situation and even how they related to...
Iraqi Kurdistan and their leaders in 1966 when Saddam was just grasping for absolute power. And I learned a lot by talking to them. What I gradually learned later was that both the Shah of Iran, for his own reasons, and Israel, for its own reasons, had been supporting more or less secretly the Iraqi Kurds for some time. And I don't have time to go into details now, but there developed a peculiar four-way alliance. Henry Kissinger decided it was okay to deter Saddam Hussein from joining the Arab-Israel War in 73 by encouraging the Kurds to a certain extent to keep up pressure on the Iraqi army and the Iraqi central power. And this suited Israel, of course, also, because Israel, and for reasons which seem to me quite legitimate, have always regarded, since 1948, Iraq as a serious strategic enemy. And we can go into the reasons for that if you want. But when the Shah dumped, as many Kurds have told me, dumped us in the you-know-what, not mud, but worse, in 1975 by making a deal with Saddam Hussein about the frontiers, the Shah immediately pulled out his forces, stopped all help to the Kurds with almost no notice. I was covering that whole situation on the spot then in Iran and Iraq. It was an awful shock. American policy, Kissinger and Nixon responded reluctantly by also cutting off aid, and the Kurdish leader, Mullah Mustafa Barzani, who had been soliciting American help and welcoming the Shah's help and probably also the limited help he was getting from Israel. He died a disillusioned old man in a third-class CIA pension in Washington, D.C., I think it was 78. And that really was a big disconnect in the American relationship with the Kurds, which since then built up again when the Americans protected the Kurds as best they could during the first Gulf War, the Kuwait, the war over expelling Saddam from Kuwait in 1991. And since then, the Kurds in northern Iraq have had a relatively secure, autonomous, and even prosperous existence. Certainly the most prosperous and successful existence of any of the other Iraqi factions until today.
They actually did fight each other, however, and as you describe, at one point in which in one of the factions, the Barzani faction, actually sought help from Saddam against...
That is absolutely true.
Gentlemen, yes.
There were times under all the regimes in Iraq and Turkey and Syria, going back to Ottoman times when different Kurdish factions fought each other. But now you have a Kurdish president of the Iraqi interim government, Jalal Talabani, who is one of the main faction leaders. And you have relative peace in the area and a kind of economic co-prosperity sphere, if you like, going on. And as I say, it has two effects. It helps to stabilize Iraq a bit, but it also, in the long run, could prove very destabilizing for the surrounding states, who also have Kurdish populations, big ones, Turkey, Syria, Iran. There used to be quite a few in Azerbaijan. And if they decide we're going for independence, then you're going to have a big, big regional war, because those states are not going to give up any of their territory or recognize any Kurdish sovereignty apart from their own sovereignty.
The Turks have actually threatened to invade northern Iraq if the Kurds declare an independent state.
That is correct, and the Turks resent very much the fact, the Turkish government resents very much that the radical Kurdish faction from Turkey, the PKK, Turkish Workers Party, has taken refuge in sanctuary and established bases in northern Iraq, which the Americans half promised to dislodge, but have not done so. And this is a constant source of irritation. There is certainly strong factions. I'm quite certain in the Turkish military, and the general staff would welcome any pretext to move into northern Iraq and not only eliminate, if they could, the PKK bases, but there's a more historical reason, too. Before the British and the Allies won World War I, Turkey had important oil concessions around Kirkuk in northern Iraq. Turkey lost those after the war, being on the losing side with Germany, and British and Western companies took over those concessions and have had them since. There are extreme nationalists in Turkey say, let's go back and get our old oil.
Well, it's also, both the Shia and Sunni do not want the Kurds to have control of that oil either in Iraq.
That is correct. In a geographical sense, of course, the Kurds themselves are either Sunni or Shia. I've forgotten the exact division, if anybody knows. There's some Christians up there, too, and Assyrian Christians and others. But those who live and have always lived in Kurdistan, they're very reluctant to let any central government in Baghdad, from the time of the British on down to now, get all control of their oil resources. When I visited Mullah Mustafa Barzani for the first time in 1966, he was giving me a line that he gave any other visiting Americans or Westerners. We got lots of oil here. If you'll help us, your companies are welcome to that oil. It was a very crude kind of offer, and it added to his extreme unpopularity, to put it mildly, with the central governments in Baghdad, including Saddam.
Now, I'm going to switch gears a minute because I had not heard about your book when it came out, and I've seen so many books that have come out on Iraq by people who know very little about the region and its history in this kind of rush to publish we have here, Disease in the United States. But there's not a single book I've seen that's provided the historical background that you have in this book. And when we spoke on the phone last week, you mentioned that, unlike your other books, An Alliance Against Babylon has been largely ignored by our media, and what occurs to me is that your linking of the Israel-Palestine issue with that of Iraq, and particularly the role played in fomenting the war by neocons closely connected to Israel's Likud party as well as the Israel lobby, this is something that the U.S. media doesn't really want discussed, and even the term Axis of Evil was created by David Frum, another staunch pro-Israel neocon. Perhaps you could comment on that.
Well, you're absolutely right that the mainstream media in the States, as far as I can tell, including even the last two that I worked for, ABC News and the Christian Science Monitor, tend to pussyfoot around the issue. I suppose it's out of fear of being called anti-Semitic. The recent indictment conviction of a top Pentagon analyst who was allegedly providing classified documents to AIPAC, the chief Israeli lobby group in Washington, is a case in point. It was covered very uneasily by the media, I noticed, even by the New York Times and others. You know, Richard Perle was one of the drafters of the famous document, which was sent not to the U.S., not to the Clinton administration, any U.S. officials, but it was offered to Benjamin Netanyahu, who was then Israeli prime minister, and that was a project for changing regime in Iraq, then followed by changing regime Syria, Iran, maybe other countries of the area, to reshape it to suit American and Israeli tastes.
It's interesting that that the people who wrote that document, Clean Break, Perle, Wormser, Richard Perle, David Wormser, Douglas Feith, all ended up in the administration advocating the very same program. And now they have been the leading advocates, along with AIPAC, of a U.S. confrontation with Iran. My own take is that if the U.S. would attack Iran, it would be such a disaster within Iraq in terms of what the pro-Iranian Shia would be doing towards the U.S. military there, that I don't think that this seems viable. How does it seem from where your position is, a U.S. attack on Iran?
Well, I think it would be a big, big disaster for area. First of all, the Iranians are, whether justified or not, paranoid about now being surrounded by U.S. military forces, not only Afghanistan and Iraq, but they're in places like Azerbaijan and the Caucasus, as well as in the Gulf. Incidentally, the Israelis also have two nuclear submarines with cruise missile capability, and Israeli strategists have suggested in published work that they be sent to the Indian Ocean to fire cruise missiles into Iran. So Iran does genuinely feel threatened. Leave aside the rant of President Ahmadinejad about wiping Israel off the map and so forth. Any Iranian leaders would feel the same way about what they consider the American threat. I believe that an American or Israelo-American or even just an Israeli attack on Iran with covert U.S. backing, of course, more or less covert, would bring big, big troubles in Turkey, would aggravate the situation in Iraq, certainly the situation in Afghanistan. It might cause upheavals in places like Armenia and Azerbaijan, Caucasus, and have a generalized South Asian war on our hands. There is this, look, I believe that Israel, from its point of view, and I went to Israel and interviewed a lot of their top analysts and ex-generals and so forth for the book, they had every reason to consider Iraq a strategic enemy. It goes back to the extraction of the Jews, sometimes by force, from Iraq. The Iraqi Jewish community was an ancient, very prosperous, and rather contented community with a lot of skillful professionals, which Ben-Gurion and the Zionist founders in Israel, even before the British rule ended in Palestine, were counting on getting out of Iraq to use their capital and their skills in building the Jewish state. I'm not attaching blame or moral judgment on it. It's simply fact. And some of the people that aided the immigration of the Iraqi Jews, Israelis, are very proud of what they did. And you can read their books. I've listed them in my bibliography. The point is that this extraction of the Iraqi Jews, whether caused by Israeli terrorism partly in Baghdad and the Jewish community or not, which is a controversial point to this day, it was a fact. Between 200,000 and 300 Iraqi Jews voluntarily or reluctantly left Iraq between 1949 and 1951. And the consequences of that have left a deep trauma in both Israel and Iraq. The Jews were despoiled before they left. They had to drop everything and leave all their bank accounts, their money, everything, but practically the clothes they wore before they were flown out. And that was long before Saddam Hussein. Of course, this was the time of the Iraqi monarchy, when the very wily politician Nouriel Saeed was running the show in Iraq. He was supposedly an ally of the West. Nobody objected to this. It was considered to be a matter between Iraq and Israel. The British didn't like it very much before they left because some of the Iraqi Jews who arrived in Israel became part of the militant Zionist groups, the terrorist groups that were attacking the British. But that was a very short period. And so the next big thing was Iraq's involvement in all of the Arab-Israel wars with very varying results. They were very ineffectual in 67, but they had a high profile because they're the only Arab state not bordering Israel, it sent an army in to fight with the other Arab armies. In 73, however, in the Arab-Israel War of 73, which Sadat and Hafez Assad started to get back some of their territory and get the U.S. involved in the whole thing, in that war, strangely enough, two Iraqi divisions that arrived in Syria late, but admittedly by Israeli military historians, which you can read now, they had a big effect in stopping the Israeli counteroffensive, which might have gone on to Damascus. Moshe Dayan, the defense minister, had said, "We're on the road to Damascus. There's not much that can stop us." Well, a combined army of Syrians, Jordanians, and Iraqis effectively halted a very tired Iraqi armored force of two or three divisions, just almost within artillery range of Damascus. And that made a big difference in the post-war negotiating and peacemaking, if you will.
Well, one of the things you point out is, and the history of the Jews in Baghdad goes back almost to the beginning of and it, one of the tragedies that came with the creation of Israel was the end of this flourishing Jewish community in Iraq. But over the years, you point out in the book and give examples, not just the attack on the Iraqi nuclear reactor of Sirik, but also the targeting of scientists and Western Europeans who were accused or thought by Israel of assisting both Iraq as well as Egypt in accumulating in acquiring weapons.
That's absolutely correct.
Maybe talk about that.
The Israelis recognized the Iraqi nuclear program as a threat to them and the area, and they started acting against it covertly at first before the attack on the reactor in 1981. And In effect, they were waging a secret war against Saddam just at the time when the Reagan, especially the Reagan administration, and later George Herbert Walker Bush, were cultivating if you like, really trying to improve the huge market, to improve the market facilities for American business in Iraq. Now, we're talking about the 80s, and that ended pretty much when Iraqis were expelled from Kuwait after they'd looted it and set the oil wells afire in 91. But there was, you see, Iraqi and American policy, I'm sorry, Israeli and American policy in Iraq, where it crossed purposes, because the Americans, to use vulgar expression, were sucking up to Saddam Hussein. Rumsfeld made two trips there, and the result was a reestablishment of Iraqi-American diplomatic relations that had been broken since the 1967 war. And the thing that began to bring them together in the 90s, and which has welded the, as I say in my book, has welded the American-Israeli partnership into a true military and very firm alliance, were a number of things. Saddam's threat to Western oil sources, both in Iraq and Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, the strategic threat which Saddam represented before the Kuwait war, potential strategic threat to American military power in the Gulf. I was on a U.S. Navy warship shortly before the Iraqis attacked, apparently by accident, the U.S. destroyer Sterk, if you recall. And the night I was aboard that ship, I was up on the bridge with the captain. We saw two missiles flash by the ship. Now, they may have been aimed at a tanker somewhere, but those were Iraqi missiles. And Iraq was always considered a threat to the U.S. military presence in the Gulf. That was another reason for the rapprochement. And the fact the Israelis realized that they couldn't do business of any kind with Saddam. And then he began to fire. He fired 39 missiles at Israeli coastal towns over the heads of the Jordanians and did quite a bit of damage. It killed a couple of people, but did a lot of property damage. And the U.S., by some very skillful, I think, diplomacy run by Dick Cheney, who was then Defense Secretary, at the last minute, on the brink of Israeli instant retaliation against Iraq, he held them back and said, let us take care of it. Because everybody knew that if the Israeli Air Force began to join the Allied attacks in Iraq, or otherwise the special forces intervened, which they were ready to do, this could ignite a general Arab-Israel war. The Arabs who didn't like Saddam, even they would feel they had to come to his aid. And we would have had one hell of a big, big, big war on our hands. And that, to me, was a success of the early Bush administration preventing that.
Well, the first Bush administration had quite a few conflicts with the Israeli government at that time. I know Moshe Aarons wrote a book called Broken Clint, in which he accused Bush and Baker of betraying the covenant between Israel and the United States, as if there was some formal covenant like the U.S. Constitution. I know Israeli pilots were apparently waiting in their planes to get the coordinates to go and attack Iraq, but the U.S. government, Bush and Cheney, Baker, wouldn't give it to them simply because
that
they realized
correct.
What would happen. One thing is interesting is the relationship between Israel and Iran. And even, as you point out, under Khomeini, despite the violent rhetoric against Israel by the Khomeini regime, they were dealing with Israel because they needed to get spare parts for...
Absolutely. The Khomeini regime never stopped dealing with Israel, mostly under the table. It was an old tradition from the Shah's day when the relationship was much less open, was much more open, and there was active cooperation in intelligence, rearmament, and everything else you can think of in between the Shahs, Iran, and Israel. There was even for a time a brief joint Iranian-Israeli missile project. It was codenamed Flower, but that wasn't very popular in Washington or anywhere else, and it was dropped.